Yeah, like a node. So I connect to the node. So that would have a 1 meter door to it. And then that would connect to the Destiny Lab, which is our lab, like I mentioned before. That's the one with the urine recycling unit in it. And then that connects to another node, and that node has six doors to it. One goes off to the European lab, Columbus, when we drop it. You know, out of the side of that node is the European Columbus lab, and out of the opposing side, you have the Japanese setup. They have the big, that one's big, that one's like 35-foot long room, you know, about 14 feet wide. That's the biggest one of the whole group, and that's, and so that has doors, and then coming out of the top of that thing is there's another part of the Japanese lab, and that's another room, and that has a door. So there's got to be, let's see, one, two, it has to have six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11, 12, probably about 15, 16 doors from one end to the other, Dick.
Fantastic. I'm amazed you've got that much memorized. You can count them in your brain like that. Have you seen the special PBS story, which has been repeated, about the manned orbiting laboratory, the American and the Soviet equivalent? Have you seen that PBS program, Paul?
About which one? A man orbiting what? I missed that thing.
About the Mall? Yes. What was the name of the Soviet craft that was in that spy, the space spy story that's been running for the last week on PBS on Channel 21? Eric, what was the name of the Soviet equivalent of our manned orbiting laboratory?
No, I can't think of it. It starts with a Z. It'll come to me. It's not in the front of my mind.
Yeah, it's a funny one. Azure or something like that. Anyhow, the Soviet equivalent of the reconnaissance from space, which was done in the late 70s, when it was in operation for a couple of months, they had a sudden power outage for 2 solid hours during the time they were on the dark side of the Earth. And so the astronauts on that particular case got quite unhappy. It took them 2 hours to get power restored. Everything went black. And one of those two astronauts that were on board, one of those two cosmonauts, went into a panic mode where he was hearing all kinds of voices, and the two of them got ordered back down in a hurry. And I think there was, are you saying also, Paul, that there was an American mission where some form of panic occurred and they had to be recalled in a hurry? Back to you, Paul.
No, it was a Salyut 7 mission where the guy was, he was in a mad panic up there. There was two guys up there, and he was having problems, like Andy said, psychological problems. And they said it was this, and they said it was that, but with anything I've read about it, he just couldn't take it anymore. And that ended, you know, they shortened that mission. So, and then, actually, they left, and nobody ever went back to that space station. A lot of people think that the Russians just had the Mir. They had Salyut 7, Salyut 6. I think it was a Salyut 3. The other ones in between didn't make it to orbit. It really wasn't much. I mean, it was one big room. That's what it amounted to, and they would stay on board for a long time. Like, it's a very small version of our Skylab. And they were always two-person crews, just two, not three.
Corey Almaz. Beautiful. Almaz, well done. When it comes to the real inside story about what is it like to be an astronaut or a cosmonaut, I strongly recommend you get a hold of this 2010 book by Mary Roach, R-O-A-C-H. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for quite a few weeks. It's not on there anymore. The book is called Hacking for Mars. Hacking for Mars. And you'll get the real inside story about what it's like being an astronaut. And just give you two or three quick thumbnail sketches. 50% of all astronauts and cosmonauts, when they're first put into space, spend the first 24 hours throwing up. Call it space sickness, if you like. And it's not a function of how many flights you've made, what your previous experience is, or whether or not you've taken Dramamine pills. The Dramamine pills don't stop it from happening. They just delay when it's going to happen. So that's one of the fine details. Another fine detail is all of the procedures required for waste removal from a human being. I guarantee the total story when it's described to you, it's about 10 times more difficult and unpleasant than you can imagine. So you put a man or a woman in weightlessness, lots of terrible things start happening, and life is not quite as simple and as easy as you would think. Read the book and you'll get the inside story. I think we've given Andy more information than he needed. Andy, are you still there, W2CVL, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Don't tell me the end, Dick. I got one chapter left.
W2BXO. All right, I'm here. I have to just do something, so I have to leave. But I can imagine what they go through. But actually, I can't imagine. But it'll be interesting to see, to find out. All right, anyway, I got to go because I got to finish up what I'm doing here. I've got 10,000 things going on. Thanks for the information, and we'll continue that next time. Give it to WBTXO. Seriously, Dick, I called you today on the phone. If you're around tomorrow, give me a call, and I will talk to you about other things unrelated to amateur radio. WBTXO, see you later.
Very fine, Andy. Frank, you've got it. Go ahead.
Very good, Dick, and good to speak to you and now and Andy again. Two sort of related questions and points. First of all, I take it that this bit about twins being in space and on the same vehicle at the same time is interesting. I take it that the Sullivan Law, which I believe applies to the U.S. military, or at least the Navy, does not apply spacecraft, possibly because they're civilian vehicles. I wonder if anybody's thought about that. And second of all, I wonder if any of you guys caught Michi Yukaku's show, Sci-Fi Science, the episode on interstellar communications with SETI. It was about 2 weeks ago, where his thinking seems to be that our approach to SETI is much too narrow, and that we really need to be thinking about things like X-ray radars and, looking for things in the, looking for X-ray lasers and that sort of things, and that just looking in the RF spectrum for ETs may be a much too narrow view. So I guess the sociologists would call it an ethnocentric view. Well, it's the way we do it, so it's the way everyone else is going to do it. Go ahead, Dick, WB2BXO.
When it comes to looking for different portions of the spectrum, looking for unusual signals that are either modulated or unmodulated, or they're very weak or very narrow or very far away and whatever, you could say all of the hardware that is on the drawing board and is about to be launched, the Webb Space Telescope, among others, for instance, is a good example where it's going to be a 6.3-meter diameter instead of Hubble, which is the biggest thing we've got up there right now, is only a 2.3-meter diameter mirror. And it's going to be looking at infrared, which gives you a lot more penetration of clouds of dust and whatever. So the hardware being put up is going to be giving you the ability to detect some of these other signals, as I see it, Frank. Very similar to what happened when you started looking for just the optical output from your telescope and start looking for modulation. And in 1968, they suddenly discovered what they called the LGM signal, Little Green Men, and it was pulsars. And eventually we discovered that pulsars are a natural phenomenon. But at first, to find a signal that was so extremely stable, a pulsed signal that was so extremely stable, as if it was an extremely high Q crystal resonator. At first, people thought it could have been an example of extraterrestrial intelligence. So by way of the hardware being developed and being deployed, I think we're moving in a direction where we will have the ability to see things like what you're describing, Frank. And you're absolutely right. To look only for radio is looking a little bit too narrowband. You've got to look literally DC to light. Well, let's call it DC to cosmic ray. Let's include ultraviolet and X-ray and everything else, cosmic rays. And in theory, gravity waves. Can you imagine if you can modulate gravity waves, what kind of signal you could send? And back to you for any further comment on this, Frank. M2, WB2BXO, K2RIW.
Yeah, that is interesting. I think another thing Dr. Taku commented on his show was that just looking at modulation may not be enough. Signals that sound natural, you look, that you also presumably need to analyze them for mathematical patterns that indicate language. His favorite example is the vocalizations of dolphins, which sound like random noise, but supposedly when they've been analyzed, in fact, by somebody working on a NASA grant, I think he said, they turn out to appear to be a very complex language. So he said, just looking for modulation isn't enough. Signals that sound natural may very well indicate something else. I hadn't heard that one before, but that's very interesting also. Go ahead.
Okay, glad to hear that people are thinking out of the box, so to speak. To believe that life occurred in just one place in this galaxy or this universe, and we're in that one place, that takes awful provincial thinking, awful narrowband thinking. There's an awful lot of evidence that life as we know it will happen every time as long as you've got the raw ingredients and you wait long enough. I mean, the Stanley Miller experiment strongly implies that. The fossil records that we're slowly discovering and all the evolution that's going on this planet. There's a lot of strong evidence that life is a fairly natural process as long as the right ingredients are there. The Goldilocks zone, liquid water, for hydrocarbon life. And does all the life have to be hydrocarbon? Another interesting set of hypotheses there. There's probably ways of making a lifelike thing out of silicon. Any of these molecules that are capable of running into great big chains.
Life on Earth is based on hydrogen sulfide.
Now let's have a couple of words on that one, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, you've probably seen it. In the Pacific, near the volcanic vents, the main saturation is no oxygen. There's hydrogen sulfide coming out. You have all these weird marine animals, like the tube worms and other types of fish. I'm sure you've seen that, Dick. And it's actually based on hydrogen sulfide and a different series of chemical reactions that break down into materials that the cells can use.
Yeah, I think Ballard is the guy who did some very deep sea diving to discover those animals. Is that true?
Yeah, I think it was the Alvin that actually went down to see them. I don't remember the guy's name, but there were a bunch of people on it, and they brought him up. There's been a number of NOVAs and National Geographic specials on. I'm sure you ran across one of them.
Sure have.
One of the dives on the Alvin, when he was doing the postdoc, I don't know. Ballard probably claims credit for the discovery anyway, knowing that business.
Yeah, he certainly has spent an awful lot of time at some very deep depths, at very high risk as I see it. And when you listen to his special, when you hear him describing how he sprung a leak one time in the flotation mechanism while he's some ridiculous number of feet below the surface, and they start descending to the surface, ascending to the surface as fast as possible, and watching the rate of leak to try to find out whether or not they're going to stay alive. Interesting episode to be in. I think we've answered all of the questions of people who signed in with a question or a comment.
I have a question for you.
It is, yes.
Go ahead, Eric.
All right. Now I got a couple of 4CX250Bs. I can't make up my mind as to, I want to run a Class AB1. Can't make up my mind whether I want to drive it from the cathode or from the grid. If I drive it from the cathode, looking at the tube spec, the impedance, I guess, is about 120 to 150 ohms. Typically, the way I would use a tube like that is I'd probably tie the filament to the cathode. And then whatever the input coil, would, you know, whatever the input resonator would be at 120 ohms, and I'd probably tap it at 50 ohms and make that my input to the cathode. What do you think the advantage of cathode driving over grid driving would be in this case? And don't forget, I want to run Class AB1 because I want to do some AM stuff. Maybe some video even.
And what frequency of RF are you going to be operating at, Eric? Or is it strictly audio and video? Go ahead.
Well, let's put it this way. It would be at the upper limit of the tube, which would be in the 430 range. But then again, if I were to put something like that together, I could also make it work on 6 meters or 2 meters. It wouldn't be video, but it might be AM.
Here's my view on that one, Eric. As you study the way the tube really works, you'll discover that when you drive the cathode and you want full output of the tube, I think it takes something like 30 watts or 40 watts of drive, but cathode drive has a natural kind of built-in, let me call it feedback. You drive at that frequency, you drive the grid with a grounded cathode, and 5 or so watts of drive per tube will give you full power output. But you don't get anywhere near as much linearity. When it comes to third-order intermodulation distortion, two-tone testing, cathode drive with a greater amount of drive power, if your drive itself is linear, will give you a lot more linearity. However, if you want to really make a highly efficient rig, I know there are ways that you can take samples of the output, readjust the drive accordingly, do curve shaping, so to speak, and you could get back the linearity. So you get a little bit more power output when you drive the cathode. That's a minor difference. You get a hell of a lot more linearity without working for it, but you drive the grid, and if you're smart enough, I believe you can get the exact same linearity, but you're going to have to work for it. Over to you, Eric. Well, I just want to check that.
IPAs I've ever worked on usually are cathode driven. I think you gave me the answer to that. Why? Well, I calculated it too. It's probably going to take about maybe about 15 watts to drive it. Really not a heck of a lot. But I have a feeling that's the way I'm going to go. It's probably a lot easier. And the real trick with this one is going to be I'm not going to build a linear supply. I'm going to build a switching supply for the high voltage. So that's going to be a real trick.
Yeah, and if you had a whole lot of time, you could do envelope restoration techniques where you modulate the B-plus on the plate with your switching regulator by pulse width modulation at an ultrasonic or an RF frequency. Therefore, you adjust the plate voltage depending on the envelope you're trying to produce, and therefore that final stage could run a lot higher efficiency. Again, that takes an awful lot of work. And if you don't do it just right, you could be putting out all kinds of undesired extraneous signals. I have a whole lot of, what's the word I'm looking for? Residuals is not the right word. Artifacts. You've probably seen those techniques where you modulate the plate voltage as a function of the instantaneous envelope that's required. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, I have, but I don't think I'm going to go that route. It's too much trouble. Actually, the thing that I'm going to be after is bandwidth, and it's the minimum amount of group delay I can possibly get, so that way I don't have to compensate for it.
Okay, KEY comments.
And it sounds like you're going for an ATV repeater. Is that approximately true? And then I'll go over to Mel. You first, Eric.
Yeah,
Yeah, well, it's going to have, I haven't decided whether I'm going to do it with externally diplexed or internally diplexed. If I do it internally diplexed, then I'm going to have more problems. If I do it externally diplexed, I can use a solid-state amplifier for the FM because, you know, that signal only has to be 10 dB down from the main signal, which would be AM, and that's FM. I can, you know, use a Quest, the amplifier, and just use a plain old brick and be happy.
Without a doubt, the brick for the audio works, but solid-state-wise, getting TV linearity at these frequencies is, in my opinion, rather difficult. Glad to see you doing it with tubes. And cathode drive sounds like the right way. Mel, K2KEY, KQRIW in the second half.
This is K2KEY. Well, a few words about these tubes, which I've also built a number of amplifiers around, nice compact amplifiers and all. Nice little tubes to work with, cheap. Plenty of them available, you know. However, if you look at the really design of these tubes, the way IMAX originally designed these things, they said that they cannot, they advise you never to use them in, for instance, Class C grounded grid circuits because of the element geometry led to very high grid current and destructive values of grid dissipation. They also, I remember mentioning, for instance, if two tubes were employed in a circuit, with the driving signal applied to, say, the cathode circuit, that would be done, you know, in, for instance, a common grounded grid configuration, grid and screen elements become RF ground. Let me let it drop. How that class AB1 operations, the grid bias, of course, and the screen potentials are applied to the tube. I mean, if that's the original theory, I remember it was quite well printed up in the sheet that IMAX had on those tube stick over.
Yeah, Mel's bringing up a very interesting point. The maximum dissipation of the screen grid is 12 watts. Maximum dissipation of the control grid is 2 watts. When you're driving the control grid with grounded cathode service, if you lose the screen grid or the plate voltage, essentially nothing bad happens. When you're driving the cathode with your 15 watts, if anything happens to that screen or plate voltage, I think you might burn up that grid awfully fast if there isn't a pretty intelligent protection circuit in there, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
I'm kind of aware of that, and protection circuit's not such a hard thing, especially with the switch. The switch is pretty easy to do. All you got to do is monitor the grid current, and, you know, have to preset limit is just shut down. You do the same thing with the screen, and, you know, if either one of them has a problem, the current's going to go up. I can do it solid state, except that the transistors, I mean, if I was doing it at, say, 200 megahertz, I got the perfect transistor for it. I don't, you know, that's what the VHF transmitters are made out of. I got lots of them. They don't work up at 400. The transistors up at 430, 440 get to be really expensive. The tube's just an easier way to go. Actually, it's harder to build than doing it solid state, but I got lots of them, so, you know. And besides, it's a different kind of challenge. It's, you know, there's some metal work involved, and you can't use a, you know, a standard pie-type tank and, you know, have some bandwidth. You gotta do a little bit of stuff to make it work over 6 megahertz.
Yeah, the kind of power you're looking for at that frequency will force you into a 10-volt power supply with a zillion amperes, very well regulated. And that's not easy. Whereas the 2,000 volts required for a 4CX250B at a quarter of an ampere with ordinary old-fashioned oil-filled capacitors and filter chokes and whatever, fairly conventional, fairly easy, lots of history behind it.
correct you on the power supply there. Go ahead. For example, when you watch Channel 13, you're looking at a 50-volt supply, so just a power transformer, a couple of bridges, and a bank of capacitors. There's no regulation. So, you know, they really don't bother to regulate that. There's no need to.
You're saying that the raw B-plus into the solid-state driver circuit, if I understand correctly, or maybe you're talking about the final, is not voltage...
About the final.
Say that again?
I'm talking about the power amplifier. The way a typical TV transmitter works is you do all your VSD, you do your filtering, you do everything, you do your modulation at low level. And then you run it into, not a Class C amplifier, you know, it's a Class AV1 amplifier, but they don't bother to regulate the 50 volts going to the output transistor. And we're talking kilowatts here.
What's the amount of ripple that's on that 50-volt power supply, Eric?
It's just some. It's pretty small, but it's tolerable. You don't see it.
In the fashion of, in the old days of analog television, where the current...
We're talking analog.
Yeah, the current drain of the final stage is hugely different depending on whether you're transmitting a black picture or a white picture. If that power supply is unregulated, isn't that voltage going to change an awful lot?
Not really. You do feed the transmitter with the regulator. It keeps it within like 2 or 3%. But there's very little ripple. There's some ripple, but not much. And each stage is it's running. Each pair of MOSFETs are running in push-pull, and they all get added together. And trust me, nobody regulates it.
In order to get enough linearity out of that analog television transmitter, was there any kind of envelope detection and feedback used to improve linearity?
Yeah, you would think so. In the digital stuff they do, in the analog stuff they don't. Okay, in the analog transmitter, you've got a whole bunch of pre-correction that you tweak. Like, in some transmitters it's like 16 knobs. On the one that I had, it was 8 knobs. Allows you to adjust the differential phase, differential gain. Another characteristic called ICPM, which basically minimizes the 920 hertz beat that's created, which will actually create biting of sound. And that's pretty much it. In the digital world, we actually have feedback from the output of the transmitter back to the exciter to compensate the thing.
Sounds like fun. How soon do you believe that network you're building might be operational?
Well, considering I've got so many other things to do, including, house moving and that kind of stuff, it's going to be a while. Plus, I've got to lay out all the mechanical stuff and make the chassis and pop the holes. I got the tube sockets. Actually, I got these nice tube sockets. It's got the bypass caps built into them. And then I got a friend in California that wants to do the same thing at the same time, so I'm going to probably have him machine. He's got the big machine shop, so I'm going to have him machine a lot of his stuff and make two of them.
Sounds like you're using an SK630 socket. That's the one with the great big high screen grid UHF bypass built in. I presume this is a combined operation with what Andy is doing with reference to ATV?
Well, Andy's doing his thing, I'm doing mine, so. I got my site. I want to put it up at Plainview. My only problem is I'm going to probably wind up being vertically polarized instead of horizontally polarized.
You can't go horizontal because?
Well, legally I'm not allowed to climb the tower. And I have a couple of antennas that work on those frequencies on the tower. And if I was going to do something omnidirectional, then I would have to make a slot or something like that and put it up there. So, that might happen, but that's not in the plans at the moment.
Understand. Good luck with that project. That'll keep you off the street tonight. Did I hear your words earlier? Are you in the process of moving from point A to point B?
Let's put it this way. I'll probably be moving closer to you in the next 6 months.
You're going to be giving me TBI.
Very doubtful. K2RIW, K2RIW.
That was a joke. Okay. Wesley, what would you like to discuss next? Into XJN and the group, K2RIW.
Into XJN. I have a few questions about the satellite. I recently acquired the Millink attachment, and we were talking with John about what would happen if I decide to mill the ferrite, because the ferrite is made from very fine grain, and this grain before gets pounded is oxidated to make this powder isolated. Then when I put it on the lathe, let's say, of a pound, like 20-30 of them feeding the pipe, then I'm gonna disturb that outer structure of the ferrite. And the question is, am I right or wrong? John says that no, it shouldn't be any difference. What I want to do is, for now, I don't want to do it. I just want to know what would happen if. Let me drop. Another question that I have is, I've got a slip from the UPS that the ferrite roughly 125 millimeters by 80 by 12, which would be close to 5 inches by 3 and a quarter by 47, 0.47 of an inch, 40 of them are on its way. So I'm going to be able to create a fairly big pipe around 20 inches. Now, let's say I put the wind on the top of it, and because I have a very big hole inside, let's say I feed another pipe of the ferrite with the winding on it. My question is, how would then this structure behave if I feed this outer coil from the generator, and I would see what's going on in the inner one? Now, I'm going to have on the sides between these two pipes approximately 0.47 of an that would be 0.83 of an inch of gap. What is then that gap has to do with the positioning, if it that change something or not? So you have three questions, and to exit.
When it comes to machining ferrite, I think you're going to discover it's a pretty hard substance, which in the process of attempting to machine it, it cracks very easily. Because ferrite, toroids, and things like that are made in so many different shapes and diameters and thicknesses, I would make an attempt to buy the raw material in the size you need before stacking them, rather than machining them. I think the machining operation could be troublesome. But once you do the machining, you're really worried about whether or not you're going to be changing the properties of the outer surface of the ferrite. I think the answer is no, but I'm not sure. When it comes to making an inner and outer diameter and an air gap between the two on this long, I think you said 20-inch long pipe, there's going to be an inner pipe and an outer pipe of ferrite with an air gap in between, I don't know I don't know what that's going to do. Whether or not the... I think you're trying to make the equivalent of a primary and a secondary winding, where one is concentric with the other, with ferrites around each, is what I think you're trying to do. Is that approximately true, Wesley?
Yes.
KC2QIQ?
Yeah, you work with all kinds of crazy magnetic materials. What's your best guess on this one, Glenn?
Well, what I suggest is going to happen there is that typically the windings in a transformer, if you look for coupling between the windings, they want to be pretty much on the same magnetic layer. So if you have a ferrite barrier or another magnetic transformer in between, I would suggest that there's just going to be very, very poor coupling between the two windings and lots of loss. K2RIWKC2QIQ.
Yeah, if I understand him correctly, he's going to have an inner set of ferrite toroids all stacked up in an axial manner that makes a ferrite pipe, and it's going to be a solenoid winding around that ferrite pipe. And the first ferrite pipe with winding goes inside of a second ferrite pipe with an outer winding on that one. That's what I believe Wesley is describing. Is that approximately true, Wesley?
That is correct.
Now, when you make a solenoid winding in that manner on a ferrite pipe, the magnetic field flowing down the center of the toroid solenoidal coil. Is this what I'm trying to say? Solenoid. Yes. The solenoidal coil. The magnetic field flowing down the center experiences very little reluctance. But then to close those magnetic paths, there's got to be an equal path of air on the outside, equal number of lines of force, magnetic lines of force. And if you have an outer winding, outer ferrite pipe inside the first one, even with an air gap, it is my guess that the inner solenoid winding will experience a lot more inductance as you add the outer ferrite pipe, even though there's an air gap there. So, I see a mechanism by which the inner winding, even with that air gap, is going to have a lot of coupling to that outer solenoid winding. Do you see where I'm going with that one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Yeah, I see what you mean by the inductance effect. But I don't think that the coupling is going to be very good, because mainly the what really creates the coupling is that they have to be on the same magnetic flux line. And, you know, once you have, like, even if you take a toroid, and you want to make a toroid with poor coupling, you put the windings on one side of the coil, and you put another winding on the opposite side of the coil, and you'll have very, very poor coupling between the two windings. But if you take the same toroid, and you bunch the wires all up on top of each other on one side of the toroid, you'll have very, very good coupling. So now if you've got two separate windings, and then with ferrite in between blocking the two, that's even suggesting that those magnetic lines of force are going to line up, because the air gap is really between the top and the bottom, the north and the south pole of these windings. So they've got huge, huge, huge air gaps in the magnetic path length, if you follow what I'm saying. And then, of course, the fact that there one is on the inside geometry and the other is on the outside geometry with ferrite separating those two windings, I think they're going to be pretty poorly coupled. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, the more I think about it, the more I'm going to partially agree with you.
Okay, now, what I'm let's say I do it this way. I use the two cups from the very soft iron from left and right inside. So I'm closing the magnetic field like this.
The inner solenoid with its toroidal winding on the outside of it, it's going to have a magnetic field flowing down the center, and another magnetic field closing the loops around the outside at a higher diameter than the solenoid winding. That's going to go through the outer magnetic pipe, the outer solenoid, the outer ferrite pipe. However, the outer solenoid coil, at any instant of time, when it comes to coupling, is going to look at the total amount of magnetic field within its winding. Within its winding, there is a inner solenoid with its own completely closed magnetic path. So I think I'm going to agree with Glenn. I see a mechanism by which the amount of coupling between the inner coil and the outer coil is going to be kind of small. It's too bad that both solenoid windings can't be on the same diameter. Then they will couple very well. Is that possible, Wesley? N2XJN, K2RIW?
Okay, let me tell you what I was thinking about. I'm trying to find the French patent. Two French guys applied for a patent a few years ago. What they did is actually they took a ferrite, whatever ferrite, ferrite rod, put three winds on it. One of the winds had delivered DC. The other wind had delivered 201.4 megahertz from the generator. The third wind was the receiver, was generating the frequency in around 400 hertz for some reason. Now, they used the U-shaped soft iron closing, that means that ferrite goes to close that U-shape, a soft iron U. And they claim over there that they were able to reach the other unit. I'm trying to look at that link to send it to you. Back to you.
Okay, so there's a DC current flowing through one of the windings, 21 megacycles, 0.4, going through another winding, and the third winding was the receiving winding, and it was looking at this complex waveform of a partially saturated iron from the DC current simultaneous with the RF current, if I understand correctly. And all of this was on a ferrite rod, or then you described it as a ferrite U-shaped or horseshoe-shaped device.
KC2QIQ in attendance.
The ferrite part would be the one piece. Then you see that you have another piece which is U-shaped, made from the soft iron. That U-shape is made this way, that if you put that ferrite on the top of that U-shape, you're actually closing the magnetic flux.
And the U-shaped soft iron had no windings on it. It was just there to complete the path. Is that what you're saying, Wesley? Okay, Glenn, you wanted to make a comment on this.
Yeah, but what's happening here is it's an interesting technique. What will happen is if you have a bar of ferrite, and let's say you wrap a winding around it, and basically what will happen is you have a very, very large air gap around the outside edge. And what they're basically doing is, and the air gap, of course, has got a permeability of 1, and the ferrite's got a permeability of like 2,500 or, you know, some very high permeability number. What you can do is if you want to keep the air gap uniform and basically close it, what you can do is you can use something with an intermediate permeability, something like iron. Now, you can the iron can withstand some DC offset so it won't saturate, and basically just close the magnetic path length with the iron. So in other words, they're just using the U-shape to close the path length with something a little bit higher than a permeability of 1 of air. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Out of curiosity, Glenn, would there be any advantage of having, let's assume now that your ferrite rod with the windings is horizontal, you've got a U-shaped object below it,
and a second U-shaped object above it, doubling the amount of external magnetic material. Would that lower the reluctance of the pad? And if so, you then carry it all the way, put one forward, one aft, and eventually you make a whole circle of these U's, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, my understanding of it, Dick, is that the magnetic path length is basically the that's the path at which the lines of flux are running in that loop. So basically, by closing the path length around the bar by adding the U shape, you're defining the electromagnetic path. So basically, anything around either the U shape or the ferrite is basically sharing the same magnetic path. Except for, I guess, where, you know, the little gaps where the iron is pressed up against the ferrite. Now, being that that's a uniform field, anything outside of that, like next to it, won't share that magnetic path length. QSL?
Understand. Let's go to the next step. The ferrite rod, which has the three windings on it, if it itself was bent into a complete circle, so it is a toroid, would that be an advantage in your mind? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, I think mechanically, things like that are done. People do that. In other words, they basically have some ferrite, and then they'll mix with other things, and it makes the shape and the geometry easier to work with. But keep in mind, the winding itself and the coupling doesn't really too much depend on the shape as much as the proximity of winding to winding. So in other words, if the coil form is coupling or very, very closely coupling the windings right on top of each other, either on a straight part of the U or in a straight pair to the ferrite, the coupling is really being done right within the winding to winding.
Well, they claim that they were able to reach over unity of 1600, and that's 1600%. Now, a few guys experimented with that, and they've got some results on it. Now, what I was thinking is that I could put two pipes. One is the outer pipe, one is the inner pipe. Then I have an air gap inside. And then I'm closing this 20-something inch pipe, both pipes, concentrically with the soft iron U perspective.
Wesley, let me backtrack for a second here. When you had the ferrite rod with three windings on it, and then you closed the magnetic path with a soft iron U-shaped object, is the best belief that the gain, the above unity, was occurring because there were two different kinds of magnetic materials? One is ferrite and the other is soft iron. Is that the belief where the excess was coming from? Back to you, Wesley.
That is correct. It's being called pumping coils, where the resonance frequency FP equals 2FO. And what is actually happening, I got to send it to you, that file, so this way you would see that.
Now, you're proposing to make a modification of the ferrite rod plus soft iron U, pumping coils or pumping ferrites, I think you're calling it. And you believe that the three-dimensional shape of the magnetic circuit is something that can be perfected and the efficiency can be improved, is what I think you're saying. If you make it a circumferential circuit by an inner and outer pipe of ferrite, but still, is your inner and outer ferrite pipe, one of them going to be soft iron and the other is the ferrite material?
That is correct. That is correct. It is going to be this way. Yeah, it is going to be this way. What's happening is magnets are used to align magnetic domains. That means not the magnet, but the soft piece of iron becoming somehow magnetized, south and north, north and south. Depends on the frequency changes. Okay, so we might say that the magnets are used to align the magnetic domains in the ferrite. And to pump coils, they are used to create the torque of the magnetic domains. That's the whole idea of a fuse.
I wonder if you and John should crawl first and run later. By that I mean, would there be any advantage in first duplicating the experiment of the ferrite rod with the three coils coupled to the soft iron U-shaped object? Would there be any advantage in making that circuit first, confirming its operation before going the next step of this new mechanical layout of the inner and outer pipe that you're describing? Over to you, Wesley.
Yeah, of course, you're completely right, 100%. And that's what's supposed to be done. Since I'm getting to the machining shop right now, I would be able to make it a bridges. I really took seriously the advice of Eric and Glenn to do not do it sloppy way. So, yes, definitely I'm going to do it.
I'm going to give you an example of something that has occurred to me in the last month, my own personal experience, where I decided to take the slow, conservative approach. And my goodness, am I glad I did it. I was developing an antenna that has to cover a lot of frequency in a lot of small, very small space. And I had built three various models with slightly different shapes. Two of them didn't work very well. One of them worked. It did 85% of what I wanted. When I was about to build the fourth, fifth, and sixth model, it would have been extremely fast to take apart the materials of models 1, 2, and 3. I decided to go slow and leave them alone and build brand new models. And model number 4, which was supposed to be better, was a terrible failure. Model number 5 was a terrible failure. And I was awful glad that I left model number 3 alone. I could always refer back to it saying, at least I know what does work. And I could prove the results when someone come along and said, how's the progress going? Show me what you got. I'm very glad I didn't take apart the working model. So in your particular case, where you know by someone's previous report that the rod, ferrite rod plus the U-shaped object does something, start off with that and leave it alone as you start building these modified models that you believe are going to give better performance. As opposed to, had I taken that apart, by now I would have been awfully discouraged. So start off with something that works, leave it alone, build a brand new one with what you believe is an improvement. There are cases where that'll save you an awful lot of mental anguish. I wonder if you've run into anything like that in the past, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think that's just part of the engineering experience, Dick. You know, it's funny you mention that because so many times, you know, you build a prototype and, you know, you build the first 5 or 10 pieces and, you know, you're looking at them just to check performance and evaluation. And sometimes it's amazing how just the tolerances and little differences between them are so severe. It's amazing. And then eventually, you know, you work that engineering process out so you get them all to work the same. And it really allows you to learn a lot about what's going on. You can find out where the tolerance problems are, where issues are that are going to be possibly in manufacturing, and just working out all the bugs. And when you get all of them working the same way, wow, it's amazing what you're really learning there. And you're right. When you get something working the first time, put that one on the side. Now start working on the ones that aren't working and finding what's actually going on there. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I believe you're discussing a production run in which you want them to all work well within the tolerance limits. I was doing a kind of development, a research and development, to try to develop an antenna that meets all the requirements within the package size. And so I'm building models that were all relatively different, intentionally looking for better performance. And I thought I knew what was happening with the model number 3 that was working quite well. And I said, well, I'm going to push that parameter in that direction because that's what's really making it work. I'm going to push it a little bit further on model number 4. I was very tempted to simply modify model number 3. And had I done that by now, I would have been very discouraged. awful glad I left it alone, built a brand new model number 4, even though it took me an extra day to do that. And it was a terrible failure. And at least I knew what to go back to. And I learned a lot in the process. Now, you know of a system that does something desirable. The ferrite rod plus the U-shaped soft iron. I recommend you build one of those and then build what you believe is a supermodel and start comparing the two. I think you're going to learn more in the process, even though it's going to be more effort. That's a recommendation. I'm not sure, but I'm still making that recommendation. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, you can check your email. That's the last email that I sent you. This is the one that shows the example of 3 coils in the U-shape soft iron. And, that's what I'm supposed to do. Both of you are completely right. The only problem that is here is that I've got extremely good price for this ferrite, the huge one. But every time I want to have another sample, something that I did and I left over, I have to spend close to $400 just for the ferrite. So that is very much expensive. Back to you.
Okay, I'm looking at something called Michael Meyer Mace Solid State Energy Converter. I see the 3 coils. I see the soft iron loop that's closed. I've now got a picture very similar to what you described. Are you saying that to build that structure is going to be expensive, Wesley? Is that what you're saying?
Well, if I use this ferrite pipe, which is close to 5 inches in diameter, each ferrite, 20 inches long pipe, that is around $400. Actually, $340. And it was a special price. Normally, each ferrite costs $36. Back to you.
Let me try to find out a little bit about how you went from step 1 to step 2. I'm looking at now a ferrite rod with a soft iron U-shaped closed path. And that's a considerable number of mechanical simultaneous changes when you go to these two ferrite pipes, neither one is soft iron, with a inner solenoid winding and an outer solenoid winding as far as the inner ferrite is concerned. That's a lot of changes. Are you sure you want to make that number of changes simultaneously and believe you're still maintaining the same theory of operation? Over to you, Wesley.
Of course I shouldn't do it, and to XGM. That's what I'm thinking. Maybe I can have a removable rod. So if I make the U-shape, just make sure that I can follow the instruction here. But the thing is, when these guys patent their application, they made the patent this way. So, of course, it's good for the patent office, but the secret how to repeat that are not so easy to understand. That means they few guys were trying different configuration, and they stated that they were able to get the results, although not 1600. And there was a suggestion that it has to do something with the concentric pipes. Just a suggestion. So I'm thinking about, since I have this big ferrite, if I would be able somehow to have repeatable operation by just reusing the same big ferrite core.
I do remember when I was using a kind of magnetic structure called a YIG filter, Y-I-G filter, yttrium iron garnet filter. And when I used them at the lowest frequency region where they still operated, roughly 1.8 gigahertz, and if I put